He needed to get closer, to walk amongst this devastation so that he might better comprehend it. So it was that the Primarch of the Raven Guard stole into the Urgal Depression and drew upon the ability he had possessed since his first memory, but had revealed to no one. He knew not how it came to be, but if he focused his thoughts, he could pass unseen amongst others. Long he had honed this power in the fighting against the slave masters, walking through their defenses in plain sight. His followers had not been aware of his special talent, but there had been plenty about their mysterious leader they had not known. It was not that he literally disappeared. More than one encounter with an automatic scanner had taught him that. It was that the minds of others ignored Korax if he wished it. Like a predator that only recognizes the shapes of its prey, those that Korax wished to deceive simply did not register his presence. Such was their unconscious disbelief that they even refused to acknowledge a return on a scanner sweep or the glow of a thermal monitor. To any naked eye, Korax could, for want of a better term, become invisible. Only one other knew of this, the Emperor. As he picked his way down to the depression, the Primarch thought about the day when the Emperor came to deliverance, to be reunited with his progeny. He remembered the looks of adulation and adoration on Korax's guerrilla warriors as the Emperor had stepped down alone from his shuttle. Korax's memory was as sharp as a sword point, but even he could not quite remember the Emperor's face. Though it was clear he had not seen what had so struck the others with awe, the Emperor had seemed young in body, but his eyes were as old as anything Korax had ever seen. He was of no particular stature, neither tall nor short, fat nor thin. The Emperor had asked Korax whether he recognized him when the two had withdrawn from the others. He had clearly been surprised by Korax's reaction.
As if from an old dream. Yes.
The Emperor's reply was brief. Interesting, was all he said. It was then that the Emperor had explained what Korax truly was. A Primarch. One of 20 created by him to lead mankind's conquest of the stars. Korax had not doubted a word of it. The presence of the Emperor made everything else fall into place. They had talked for a whole day of the Emperor's plans and the ongoing Great Crusade. Korax told the Emperor of what had passed on Lycaeus and of the continuing conflict with the planet below. That day, they pledged support and loyalty to each other, and the Emperor had smiled and nodded. As Korax had guided the Emperor back to his shuttle, the Master of Mankind had laid a gentle hand on Korax's arm, his deep blue eyes gleaming. Korax remembered the warmth he had felt, the elation coming from the Emperor's parting words, even though the Primarch had made no mention of his peculiar ability. You will never have to hide again. The Primarch snorted at his sentimentality. He was hiding again. Of that there was no doubt. He was not scurrying through some ventilation duct or slipping past a guard post, but Korax suddenly felt as if all the years between then and now had been for nothing. He looked at the carnage wrought at the drop site. The Iron Warriors were fortifying the hills as befit them. Columns of space marines, on foot and in their armored vehicles, stretched as far as the eye could see. Under the dark clouds, their camp sprawled across the Urgal Depression like a stain. But there was something else that darkened the grassy hillsides and windswept basin. Corpses. Tens of thousands of them. The traitors had left the dead where they had fallen. Perhaps as a testament to their victory, perhaps unwilling to sweep away the shameful evidence of their treachery. The slaughter was unimaginable, even to one who had spent his entire life at war. So many dead. Astartes killed by the hand of other Astartes. This was no mere rebellion. This was something far greater. Rebels raised their voices openly against those they despised. These traitors had plotted in the shadows and bided their time. Who could say how long Horus had been secretly working against the will of the Emperor? With a shock, Korax realized that he might have been an unwitting conspirator in this uprising. How many of Horus's orders had he followed without question? How many times had he discussed his strategies, his plans, with the likes of Angron and Fulgrim? Cloaked from view, Korax wandered amidst the bloodied piles of flesh and shattered armor. He heard harsh laughter from the traitor camps and ignored it. He saw the colors of the Raven Guard next to that of the Salamanders. Company banners lay tattered and broken in the gore-slicked grass. Here and there he saw the livery of the traitors, flecks of bright color amongst the black and drab greens of the loyalists. Korax could follow the course of the battle by the dead left in its wake. A fighting retreat here, a last stand around a chapter banner there, a counter-assault against a position over there. The scene played out like a story. The Salamanders falling back into an ever smaller pocket of resistance, the Raven Guard breaking out in whatever directions they could. A psychotic charge from Angron's World Eaters cleaving into the Salamanders' defensive cordon. Gun batteries of the Iron Warriors on the high ground. An encircling attack by the Word Bearers. Far away, the metal colors of the Iron Hands glittered in the rising sun, where Ferris Manus had led them against the Emperor's children, of his fellow Primarchs. There was no sign. Korax knelt beside the body of a Raven Guard, his chest plate rent open, his ribcage splayed. His armor bore the markings of a veteran, one of those that had come from terror and made deliverance his new home. Korax had seen untold atrocities and, in the name of enlightenment and the future, had even committed a few. Of these he was not proud, but he was sure that his cause had always been just. He had seen the slavers throttle babies to punish their mothers, and bloodthirsty crave fall upon columns of refugees. Never once had any of it caused Korax the slightest hesitation. War was not glorious. It was a desperate, messy business. But it had been his business, one in which he had excelled. This massacre was beyond the pale. For the first and last time in his life, Korax cried. He cried not for the loss of life, though it was great. He cried not for the degradation that had been heaped upon his dead warriors, though it was obscene. He cried for all Astartes, for the shame that Horus had brought upon them. They had been the Emperor's trusted sword, and they had betrayed him. It mattered not that Korax himself had remained loyal. He was Astartes, and the shame of one was the shame of all.
Will they ever trust us again?
A tear rolled down his cheek and dropped onto the fallen Raven Guard. Should they trust us? Was the next question. One that Korax did not want to ask and certainly could not answer. The Emperor made us gods, and mankind followed us, Korax thought heavily. In us he poured the hopes and dreams of humanity, and we raised ourselves up above them. He gave us armies to command and the resources of the galaxy to draw upon. What have we done with that? When we first awoke, what did we do with the power he gave us? Set ourselves up as warrior kings, with planets as vassals and star systems as our fiefdoms. Not all of us follow Horus, but none of us are beyond blame. Perhaps it is better not to trust us. Perhaps the galaxy is better ruled by men who live and die and whose ambitions are not so grand. Depression weighed Korax down as he continued his search. There was no sign of Ferris Manus or Vulcan, though he did not know whether that boded well or ill. There was but one truth to face. The Salamanders and Iron Hands were no more. If aid was to come, it would be from outside Istvan V. The Raven Guard would have to fight on alone.
Prefector, I'm detecting power surges from the orbital platforms in our grid. Weapons are priming.
The ensign's tone was worried as he turned from his console aboard the bridge of Valerius' flagship. The Remarkable.
Get me an immediate relay to the Raven Spire and put it through to my cabin.
Without waiting for a response, the Prefector hurried from the bridge into his private chamber. He flicked on the vidscreen and paced back and forth across the narrow room as the display filled with multicolored static. Commander Brand's voice cut through Valerius's agitation.
I warned you this would happen.
Valerius spun towards the screen and saw the Space Marine's face filling the display. The commander's expression was blank, giving no sign of what he was about to do.
Surely you cannot consider opening fire on Imperial ships.
It is not my decision, Prefector. You have disobeyed a direct command from your superiors. What happens next is up to you.
Valerius fought the urge to claw at his hair in frustration. He could hear the cawing of ravens even when awake, and the corners of the cabin seemed to flicker with flames.
The deaths of your men will be on your hands, not mine.
How can you say that? It is by your command that they will be killed. You would slay them out of hand? I cannot believe that even you are that inhuman.
These are inhuman times, Prefector. In following your unconfirmed orders, your men place themselves as conspirators in your insubordination.
They're just following my orders. To do otherwise would be mutinous.
Yet you choose to commit that crime on their behalf. I say it again. This is your doing, not mine.
Valerius's hands formed claws as he tried to grasp some argument or line of reasoning that would persuade Bran not to open fire. He could think of nothing. His entire claim to this endeavor was based on a dream that tormented him and a deep feeling of dread. Nothing more. Then it came to him. Valerius rounded on the screen with a last, desperate hope in his heart.
What if it is you and not me that is wrong?
Bran arched his brow in confusion as he answered.
My orders were explicit, as were yours. The chain of command is equally clear. Any error is yours, not mine.
But think of the consequences. Think not of the reasons for a moment, but think only of what happens if we follow your path and not mine.
Bran shook his head, unable to understand Valerius's argument. The Prefector continued at pace, scrabbling after the words as a drowning man might lunge for a lifeline.
If you are right, and I am wrong, what harm is caused?
If my worst suspicions are correct, you may aid the traitors.
Valerius nodded at this, thinking as quickly as his fatigue-numbed mind would allow.
Then come with me. Bring your Astartes aboard and hold a gun to my head. I would be the first to pay if there is any hint of treachery in my actions. In that circumstance, what possible gain would there be for me?
Bran shook his head again but said nothing. Valerius continued.
And what if this is just a wild chase? What have we lost by acting? Nothing.
The Space Marine remained unconvinced, and Valerius moved in for his final argument.
But consider this. Think of the consequences if, against everything you believe and have been trained for, I am right. Think! If what I say is true, no matter how, then what is the price we pay for not acting? If you come with me, history might remember you as the commander that lost his pride because he allowed a delusional army officer to fool him. Your reputation might suffer, that is true. On the other hand, would you instead be remembered as the commander that stayed at home, too proud to listen to those that warned him of danger while his Primarch needed him?
Valerius could see his words sinking in as Bran's frown deepened even further. The Space Marine's jaw worked as he turned the words over in his mind, analyzing them as he might a battlefield situation, examining them from different perspectives.
I do not believe you. Though the consequences of inaction are far greater, the more likely risk is the loss of my honor by a considerable factor. I see no benefit in your course of action.
Valerius fell to his knees, hands held out imploringly towards the flickering image of the commander.
Lord Korax needs us! He needs you!
And if he doesn't? If I go to Istvan and he welcomes me with scorn?
Valerius rose to his feet and pulled his hand across his chest in salute, fist grasping the sash.
I will give up the red and offer my life as forfeit for my mistake. I will take the dishonor, even to the ruination of my family.
An internal broadcast cut across the transmission from the Ravenspire. It was the ensign at the scanner arrays, his voice timorous and broken.
Prefector, orbital batteries have locked onto our vessels. What should we do? Prefector!
Valerius cut the link and stared at Bran.
It is your decision, Commander of the Astartes. My fate is in your hands.
We will be avenged.
Behind him, the Gula salt plains stretched for hundreds of kilometers, offering no sanctuary to his depleted army. They had fought as hard as they could, never getting caught, always moving. But now, there was nowhere left to run. The Raven Guard were trapped, sheltering in the last cover that had been left of them while the traitors scoured Urgl.
Have you ever seen such a thing?
Korax shook his head in response to Agapito's question. The might of the World Eaters Legion was arrayed against them. Tens of thousands of warriors poured up the slope, just kilometers away. From this distance, there were lines of blue and white, though much tainted with red. Some of the World Eaters had taken to daubing the blood of the fallen on their armor, marring their imperial livery in defiance of the Emperor.
He is with them.
Who?
Angrom. My headstrong brother.
Korax pointed into the mass of warriors. Amidst the blue and white armor strode a giant clad in red and gold, a great cloak of fur upon his back. Brazen chains were wrapped about his hands and wrists, a massive chain axe in each hand. Korax could hear the savage war cries of Angren's lobotomized warriors, their chants flowing up the hillside as a challenge to the Raven Guard. Korax flexed his grip on his whip as he watched the World Eater's Primarch stalking forward. He knew this was the end. He had barely 3,000 Space Marines against the might of a whole legion. He would have to face Angron, and he knew he would fall to the World Eater. There was not another Primarch that could best him in single combat, save Horus and maybe Sanguinius. Korax was an immortal lord of battle, but Angron was war incarnate. The Raven Guard had seen him leading his troops through the breach at Hell's Anvil and witnessed his talent for destruction during the Siege of Gehenna. There was no doubt in Korax's mind that Angron would slay him and take great pleasure in the act. He shuddered to think what Horus had promised the World Eater in return for his betrayal of the Emperor. Conquest, no doubt, and glory in battle. Angron had craved these things more than any other Primarch, though Korax and his brothers had all been created with a fierce military pride. What else, Korax thought? What do you gain from this rebellion against the Emperor? As Korax watched the hordes of the World Eaters streaming towards him, he guessed at an answer. Freedom. Freedom from restraint. Freedom from holding back. Freedom from guilt and orders, but freedom was not without its drawbacks. The Primarchs and their Astartes needed structure and purpose to focus their martial instincts. Without the guiding hand once provided by the Emperor, now manipulated by Horus, the legions were nothing more than a bolter without an eye to aim it. Was the wildness, the savagery of the army that raged towards him, something that hid inside every legion? Korax could not believe it was so. Duty, honor, loyalty. For the strong to fight for the weak, that was purpose. Freedom of the type craved by Angrim was an empty existence, removed of all measure and boundary, so that no act had meaning because it served no end. Korax had freed deliverance from the slave masters and then guided them into the fold of the Imperium. Perhaps he had merely swapped one master for another, but at least he was free to choose the master he would serve. Relieved at his conclusion that it was not within him to become a tyrant like Angron, Korax relaxed and waited. Astartes fighting Astartes was a horrific thing, but in his heart the Primarch knew that he would rather fall to the hand of one of his brothers than suffer any other fate. The Space Marines had built this new Imperium out of the rawness of the galaxy, and it was fitting that it would be the Astartes who would decide its fate, for good or ill.
Ah!
The first missiles from the World Eater's whirlwinds were streaking through the sky towards the Raven Guard. They refused to take shelter, proud to stand their ground against this enemy. The explosions tore through the squads, slaying dozens. Korax stood amongst it all, as if in the eye of a hurricane. His officers looked to him and drew strength from his bold defiance of the traitors. More vapor trails crossed the open skies, but something was wrong with their direction. They came from behind the Raven Guard. Korax looked up and saw broad-winged aircraft plunging down from the scattering of cloud, missile pods rippling with fire. A swathe of detonations cut through the World Eaters, ripping through their advance companies. Incendiary bombs blossomed in the heart of the approaching army, scattering white-hot promethium over the steep slopes. Korax looked on with incredulity as blistering pulses of fire descended from orbit, cutting great gouges into Angren's legion. The roar of jets became deafening as dropships descended on pillars of fire. Black dropships emblazoned with the sigil of the Raven Guard. The space marines scattered to give the landing craft space to make planetfall. As soon as the ships touched the ground, ramps wind down and boarding gateways opened. At first, the Raven Guard were in stunned disbelief. A few shouted warnings, believing the dropships to be enemy craft painted to deceive. The comm crackled in Korax's ear.
Lord Korax?
Receiving your transmission.
This is Praefector Valerius of the Imperial Army, serving under Commander Bran, my lord. We have a short window of evacuation. Board as soon as you're able.
Korax signaled to Agapito.
Marshal the embarkation. Get everybody on board and break for orbit.
The commander nodded and turned, growling orders over the comnet to organize the Raven Guard's retreat. With practiced speed, the Raven Guard dispersed, the dropships launching in clouds of smoke and dust as soon as they were full. Korax watched them streaking back into the skies as shells and missiles fell once again on the Raven Guard's position. An explosion just to his left rocked him with its shockwave. A moment later, Agapito was at his side.
Last transport, Lord!
Korax followed Agapito up the ramp, his boots ringing on the metal. As the ramp began to close, he looked out across the World Eater's army, baying like frustrated hounds.
He survived, Lord. 98 days.
Korax felt no urge to celebrate. He looked at Agapito and the other space marines.
I came to Istvan with 80,000 warriors. I leave with less than 3,000.
His words hushed the jubilant mood, and a somber silence was replaced by the sound of the dropship's roar. Korax stood beside a viewing port, the deck rumbling beneath his feet, and looked at the hills of Urgal dropping away, picturing the thousands of fallen followers that he was leaving behind.
What do we do now?
We do what we have always done. We fall back, rebuild our strength, and attack again. This is not the last the traitors will know of the Raven Guard. This is defeat. But it is not the end. We shall return.
The cloud obscured his view, blanking it with whiteness. And he thought no more about the dead.
Templar by John French. Performed by Gareth Armstrong, Tim Bentinck, Chris Fairbank, Jamie Parker, and Tanya Rodriguez. Directed by Samuel Gunn. Produced by Heavy Entertainment for Black Library. The water danced on the curved blade, and Sigismund watched it run from the perfectly still edge. Above him, the iron clouds rolled wet curtains of rain across the broken landscape. Fires still burned close by, clinging to wrecks and rubble, fighting the downpour. 10,000 warriors stood on the slopes of the macro crater, blood and battle marking their armor. All were looking down at him, their faces a wet blur on the edge of sight. He was barely aware of the silent throng. The legionary opposite him was the only thing that was real now. Every twitch of the white scar's pale armor, every breath between his sharpened teeth, every raindrop upon the silver smile of the Guandao blade, Sigismund saw and felt them all. Sigismund began to wrap a chain around his wrist. The white scar tossed his head and pointed the tip of the Guandao at the iron links.
Why do you do that?
Sigismund held his gaze steady on the curved blade and kept winding the chain tighter, tighter. The other legionary smiled, eyes dancing in a hawk-proud face. He spun the glaive, armored hands blurring around the weapon's haft, droplets scattering as it sliced the rain.
Are you afraid of losing your sword? A blade is freedom, son of Dawn. It is the wind and storm flash. Chain it, and you chain yourself.
Sigismund was not listening. The world was closing in around him, narrowing to a point that held only the flicker of the blade and the instant after it. This was his realm, as much a part of his life as the air that filled his lungs and the iron in his blood. The chains rattled as he wrapped another loop around his wrist. His pulse slowed with the coiled links. The flow of time became heavy, like oil spreading over ice. He had not wanted to do this, but the white scar had insisted. It was not enough that two legions had bled and died together, fighting the same enemy upon the same battlefield. The white scars had not expected the Imperial Fists to be there. They had not expected to share the victory, and that left something unresolved. A champion had emerged from their lines and thrust his blade into the ground at Sigismund's feet. He had looked from the blade to the warrior's smile and known that there was no choice. There was never a choice. Sigismund fastened the chain to his vambrace. He flexed one hand upon the hilt of his sword, feeling its weight shift in his grip. In the decade he had carried it to war, it had never failed him. He raised it above his head. He felt the muscles in his shoulders settle, listened to the slow rise and fall of blood in his veins. The white scar spun his weapon, then snapped it to stillness. Dirty rivulets of water streamed down the creases of his face.
Do you not want to know my name?
Sigismund looked up into the grey of his opponent's eyes. Jubal Khan, Lord of Summer Lightning and the Death That Comes with Laughter, was still smiling at him.
I know your name.
Good.
Jubal looked into Sigismund's eyes and nodded. The white scar held his glaive low at his side, the edge facing back. Sigismund watched him, weighing the rhythm of his stillness, listening to the instant stretch out. A single droplet of water formed on the blade's point. His pulse was still in his chest. His heart paused between beats. The drop of water fell. Jubal whirled forward. Sigismund cut down and his opponent spun back, his blade a blur around his body. Sigismund swung again and again, his sword like a smear of steel and scattered rain. He was scything low and high, blade whistling, and the white scar laughed as he ducked a cut and leapt into the air. The Guandao's edge winked as it arced down. Sigismund froze. Jubal's eyes were wide above bared teeth as his blow fell. Sigismund jerked aside, the curved razor edge sighing as it passed his head. His sword flashed out. Jubal pulled back snake-fast, his glaive rising, and for the first time the two blades clashed with a ring of steel. Sigismund came forwards, hammering blows down, one after another, feeling the sword shuddering in his grasp as the rain streamed past his eyes. The white scar's face was locked into a snarling mask, his smile gone. Soaking hair whipped above wide eyes as he ducked and spun aside. The Guan Dao was a razor blur, the play of weapons a spiral of slices and parries.
You are everything they say you are.
Sigismund saw the slight twitch at the corner of Jubal's eye and slid past a sudden thrust.
And you are more.
The words washed over Sigismund. In his mind, there was only the feel of his own sword, only the play of cuts and angles and balance that flowed through him like blood and breath. Like life.
But you are missing something. For all your skill.
Jubal leapt again, twisting like a bladed hurricane. He was fast, so very fast. He flicked his blade out and cut down, and Sigismund raised his sword to turn the blade. He felt a blow ring against his forearm, and then Jubal was stepping back, sodden, topknot flicking to the side. Sigismund glanced down at his arm. The links of the chain binding the sword to his wrist had been severed. Sigismund lunged. Jubal swayed like a tree in the wind, and the sword sliced through empty air. An armored heel flashed out and snapped Sigismund's head back with a crack of bone and a spray of blood. Rainbow explosions detonated in his vision. The cries of the watching white scars roared into the deluge. Sigismund reeled, his own blood blinding him. Thoughts raging inside his skull. Anger and pain and doubt and... Everything was still. He let the drumbeat of his heart roll through him. His world was the moment. His existence was the sword in his hand. There was nothing else. There needed to be nothing else. Jubal's next move was already unfolding. Sigismund could not see it. He could not see anything, but he could feel it, like the silence before thunder. His sword met the blow. The force of the impact shook his teeth in his skull. He felt his sword move, felt it ring as it deflected, strike after strike. He was going backwards, his vision a clotting blur, his feet skidding in the mud. Jubal was a scything spiral, delivering blow after blow. He was fast, faster than the wind, faster than the blink of distant lightning. But there, suddenly, like a flicker of sunshine through storm clouds, was an opening. Sigismund shifted and cut downwards. He felt the impact and struck twice more before the clang of the first strike had faded. Then Jubal was gone, spinning back out of reach. Sigismund paused, checking his instinct to follow the white scar. Jubal stood once again at the edge of the circle. Blood marked his armor, diluting in the rain as it ran over the ivory white plates. The Guan Dao was steady in his grip, but his left arm was twisted, the elbow joint leaking red. His gorget was crumpled, and cracks spidered his right thigh plate. The dancing glimmer had gone from his eyes. His gaze was suddenly older, patient, knowing.
I will not beat you. I know this. You know it too.
Jubal's lips cracked wide to show sharp, white teeth.
But the song was worth the singing.
You were beaten because you lack focus.
And you lack joy.
We exist to serve.
And there is nothing more?
Nothing more.
Jubal looked around, blinking, as though seeing the watching ranks of legionaries for the first time. Then he turned back to Sigismund and spun his weapon with his good arm.
Come. Let us finish this.
Have you killed a space marine before?
The crone's voice pulls him from the memory. He opens his eyes slowly. The hold of the gunship is a shadow-filled cave. Amber light sheens the armor of the warriors seated beside and opposite him. There are 20. Half are the chosen of his Templars, their white surcoats reduced to folds of gray in the gloom. The other half are Seneschal Rahn's men, their battered armor and shields marked by the twin axes of the Linebreakers. Around them, The frame of the gunship rattles and sings as it plunges through the void, and the distance to the comet shrinks with each passing minute. News had come from Istvan of the death of a Primarch and the treachery of four more legions. Within the solar system, remnants of those new betrayers linger still, perhaps forgotten, perhaps ready to strike. They must be hunted down and destroyed. Rogal Dorn has tasked Sigismund with that duty, and he would see it done by his own hand. His eyes move to the emissary. She sits between the armor-bloated forms of her gene-bonded bodyguards. Her exoskeleton gleams with chrome and polished carbon. Beneath the crystal of her visor, her face is a landscape of wrinkles and hard bones under pale skin, but her eyes sparkle darkly as she stares back at him. Her name is Harpocratia Morn, and Sigismund would not have chosen to have her here. That decision, like many others in recent times, is simply one that he has to accept. She smiles at him, lips twitching, as though amused by a joke only she has heard.
So, have you?
Be silent, Krohn. Your words itch like flies. Keep them to yourself.
It is Rahn, of course. The captain of the assault Kada is not wearing a helm yet, and his black hair stirs from his sharp face as he leans towards Morn. His fingers are tapping on the hafts of twin axes locked to the back of his shield. Morn looks at him as though she has only just noticed that he's there. He meets the emissary's gaze and bares his teeth. Morn raises an eyebrow and looks back to Sigismund.
So, what is the answer, First Captain?
Be...
The representative of the Emperor and his regent? The emissary of the Council of Terror? Or merely a general who has stood on fields of blood and victory since before this Imperium was won?
Morn's face no longer looks decrepit. It looks hard and cold, like a notched sword that still has a killing edge. She holds Rahn's gaze for a long moment.
Which of these things would you have me be, Fafnir Rahn?
Rahn says nothing. He is utterly still, fingers frozen where they rest upon the haft of one axe. Then his lips twitch around, and the snarl becomes a grin. He leans back, still grinning, but says nothing.
I see why you like silence. It suits you.
100 kilometers to target. Ready condition, Crimson.
Red light blinks through the hold. As one, the warriors grip their weapons. Sigismund glances down to his own sword. The blade is a reflected sliver of polished knight held across his knees. A snaking iron chain binds it to his wrist. He remembers Jubal's crooked smile and the rain dancing upon his blade's edge. The moment is coming. This is the threshold of the future that the treachery of Horus has made for them. He wants to embrace it, but wonders if that will change anything. He wishes that Morn had not asked her question. Rahn pulls on his plow-fronted helm. Morn arms a pair of chrome Serpenta pistols, and Rahn turns to her.
Why ask if he has killed our kind?
Because we are about to go into battle against them. Because in spite of the ideals of unity, space marines have died upon the blades of their own kind before. Because the answer might mean that he bears a weakness that he does not yet see.
Is that why you are here?
I am here because the Sigilite wishes it.
He will not hesitate.
You are sure?
Have a care.
40 kilometers to target. Breaching missiles loose.
Sigismund closes his eyes. In the corner of his visor display, the rune to release his mag harness glows red. He takes a slow breath, feels calm spreading through thought and muscle. He remembers all the faces of enemies and friends reaching back into the darkness. And through it all, he wonders if he will meet them again before the end.
They say that he always kills with one cut.
Only when he isn't swinging his sword like a farmer swatting flies. He has looked defeat in the eye and smelled its breath, too. But no one mentions that.
But you do.
I can say what I like of him. I have bled for the right. And no matter how good he is, he would take more than a scar if he decided to take offense. You do not have that right, no matter who you are.
But is it true that he has never been defeated? Never lost a duel? Never failed?
Never. It's one of the things that makes him so difficult to like.
Let us hope that he will not break the habit.
Reach impact in 20.
No.
Sigismund opens his eyes. The mag harness holds him firmly, but he looks down at Morn's dark eyes and sunken face.
The answer is no.
He returns his gaze to the assault ramp. Rahn braces himself. The engine noise is a rising thrum through armor and muscle alike. Sigismund tenses, ready for battle. His sword is a dead weight in his grip.
The answer to what?
What is about to happen will change everything. He is about to step through a doorway into a new age, a new meaning of what it means to be a warrior of the Imperium.
Impact in T-minus 10 seconds.
And beyond that, another future waits for him.
I have never killed my own kind.
Sigismund did not move when he heard the footsteps approaching. It had been 20 hours since he had set himself before the temple doorway, and it would be 4 more before he moved. His armor had gone into a low-power cycle, runes winking in slow amber at the edge of his visor. His hands remained still upon the hilt of the sword which rested, point down, between his feet. Overhead, the domed vault of the temple hung above the candle-diluted gloom. Great pillars soared, shadows snagging on the names cut into the black granite. Banners hung beneath the vault, their designs ragged and stained by the blood and fire of 100 battles. Silence always filled a great space, unbroken by the sounds of the star fort beyond its walls. Even in times of battle, the Temple of Oaths was a void of calm amidst the clamor. It had been designed that way, a reminder from Rogal Dorn that what this chamber represented stood untouched by all else. Here, carved into every surface, were the names and oath words of every Imperial Fist who served or had served the Imperium. On this floor, all, from highest praetor to lowest legionary, had knelt and pledged loyalty. No door sealed the arch of its only entrance, but no one entered it unbidden. To be a Templar was to be a guardian of that tradition, and with it the oaths of all Imperial Fists. A lone figure walked out of the darkness beyond. The candlelight caught the gloss of black lacquered armor and folded across a long robe of pale fabric. A hood cowled the warrior's features, but Sigismund did not need to see the face to know the man. The figure stopped 5 paces from the doorway. Sigismund did not move. Slowly, the figure reached up and slid the hood from his head. Dark hair framed a face set with green eyes. His name was Alahos, captain of the 9th Order of the Dark Angels, and one of the finest warriors ever to raise a blade in battle.
You may not enter here, kinsman.
I have no wish to.
Then why have you come?
I have come to talk to you.
Sigismund shook his head once, but did not move from beneath the arch. There was no point in talking. Not now. Not while the brooding anger of Dorn and the Lion filled the phalanx like a growing thundercloud. A dispute between these two paragons of war and nobility should not have been possible. But that had not stopped it from happening. It was not a matter of pride or of insult. It was simply a matter of two beings, both so vast in power, so alike and yet so different, clashing together like land and sea. There had been other incidents in the past, other moments when the ideals of the Great Crusade seemed to do little but fuel discord. Curs, Ferus Manus, Perturabo, the anger of all had risen against Dorn at one time or another. Sigismund hoped that this new divide with the Lion would pass as quickly as it had formed. It was wasteful, a crack in what should be the perfect blade of the Legiones Astartes.
There is nothing to say, Alahos. My lord has spoken.
Yes, and my father also has spoken.
This dispute
will pass.
And if not, how will it be resolved then?
Not my blood.
No?
No. We are warriors of the Imperium, and we were made to fight its enemies, not one another. Break that brotherhood and we are nothing.
Tell that to the World Eaters. Tell it to the wolves.
Such bloodshed serves nothing. It will not happen. Not between our legions. Not now. Not ever.
Sigismund remained unmoving. After a moment, Alohos nodded at the vaulted space behind him.
This is the Temple of Oaths, is it not?
He stepped forward as he spoke, and suddenly Sigismund's blade was barring Alohos' path. The Dark Angel raised an open hand.
Peace, brother. I will not cross the threshold. No Imperial fist may do so, save to make or renew an oath, and none who are not of the Seventh Legion may enter and live. That is right, isn't it?
The Primarch has permitted three of his brothers to enter over the years.
And if I took one more step?
Then you would never take another.
What would my blood shed upon this floor serve?
Duty.
The Dark Angel smiled, though the warmth did not reach his eyes.
What are we? Us two. What are we?
We are warriors.
But here and now, we are more than that. We are champions. If blood is needed to satisfy honor, then it will not be our brothers or our fathers. It will be ours. We are our legions, and we are our oaths. We draw our swords, but they do not belong to us. The hand that cuts and the eye that guides the cut are not the same. Duty. It binds us. It keeps us. It guides us. It is...
everything.
Aye. No matter where it leads us, or to what end.
Alohos smiled again, and Sigismund recognized the emotion in the Dark Angel's eyes. It was sorrow.
The storm may pass, but if it does not, then I wanted to be certain that we understood one another.
Sigismund explodes from the assault ramp. The outer chamber of the shrine extends before his eyes. He has never set foot upon the comet before, but he has heard his father speak of it many times. Walls of stacked skulls and polished bones arch above him. Words cover their faces, words that tell who they were in life, and the deeds that brought them here in death. Each bone and skull belong to a hero of the long Terran Wars for Unity, sent here to orbit in the light of Sol as a memorial to the price paid for humanity's dream for all time. The 17th Legion had been the appointed keepers of the Comet Shrine since its creation. 100 warriors of the Word Bearers stood guard within its halls, ever watchful, ever dutiful. But now, that duty had become treachery. Left here by their brothers, they would die beneath the empty eyes of dead heroes. Bolt gun fire greets him as he charges. Shrapnel rings from his armor, but he does not falter. He is a blur, a flash of hard edges and blade's sharpness. The first Word Bearer is in front of him, bolter rising, his desecrated crimson armor glistening with reflected gunfire. Sigismund sees unspeakable glyphs etched through the glossy red and into the gray ceramite beneath. There are more Word Bearers close behind the first, 10 at least. The barrel of a bolt gun is a wide eye staring back into his own. The steady drum roll of his twin heartbeat rises as the last stride of his charge falls. The Word Bearer's finger grips the trigger. Sigismund cuts. Blood, wet black in the flicker of bolt detonations, slashes outwards. The dead Word Bearer's grip tightens and a spit of flame roars. Sigismund feels the fiery breath of the bolt gun rattle his helm. He is already moving before the corpse even begins to fall. He cuts again and again, each step a fresh kill. He is moving forwards, and his world is a rising beat of fragmented sensations. A torso, cleaved from clavicle to groin. A hand reaching for a blade. The roar and surge of bolt fire. He hears and feels it all, but he is not a part of it. He is a single line of focus, slicing forwards, flowing from blow to blow like a river. He is aware of his brothers following behind him, forming a wedge with him at its tip. They are driving forwards, firing at sentry turrets, hacking at red-armored figures. Voices flicker across the box as the rest of the force strikes directly into the shrine itself. The resistance they have encountered so far is weak. The enemy numbers few, their tactics poor. Sigismund knows all this without thinking, without pausing from the scything rhythm of his sword. A word-bearer comes at him, faster than the rest, his head bare and skin webbed with inked sigils. Sigismund sees a blade whipping towards his neck, broad and jagged-edged. The blow is powerful, the product of training and experience. It is intended as a kill stroke, and a clean one at that. Sigismund's murderous rhythm does not even falter. He slips the blow, turns, and brings his own sword down. Only then does he see the dagger. It is small, a spike of rough obsidian bound to a bone handle, and seems to shimmer in and out of sight as though dissolving in a heat haze. The word-bearer thrusts the blade up. His eyes are wide in his tattooed face, his teeth bared in a snarl of triumph. Sigismund twists aside, yanking his sword down to try and block the thrust. The black knife gouges across his plastron plate. Pain whips through him as his flesh burns against the armor. His sword strikes the word-bearer's left arm, but the blow lacks power. The word-bearer stumbles, recovers, and thrusts again. An axe head mashes into the word-bearer's skull. Lightning explodes from the impact in a thunderclap of pulped meat and shattered armor. Ran shoves the corpse out of his way.
You deserve to die to that first, Captain. You're getting sloppy.
His armor and the face of his shield are a mass of metal scars and blood splatter. He does not look around as Sigismund closes with him. They stand shoulder to shoulder, the scarred butcher and the knight. More Imperial fists lock into line beside them, shields and swords ready, firing as they reform. A spiked mace crashes into Rahn's shield, and he rocks back under the force of the blow. Another word-bearer stands before them, his armor bloody, his feet planted on the corpses of the dead. Sigismund waits for a fraction of a heartbeat, waits until he can feel the word-bearer begin to pull the mace back.
No!
Rahn slams his shield forward. The word-bearer staggers for an instant, recovers, and swings down. Sigismund's sword takes him in the gut. He feels the blade shiver as it punches through armor, flesh, and bone. Rahn's axe takes the word-bearer's head in a single blow.
You still know nothing about war, brother, but you are learning.
Sigismund feels the flat of the Seneschal's axe head clash against his shoulder. They drive forwards over the heaped corpses. Ahead of them, word-bearers are pulling back, firing as they move. Behind them, high doors of brass and bone are closing over the mouth of a wide passage.
Secure the doors!
His brothers are moving to answer the order as soon as it leaves his lips. Five warriors, their shields held in a tight wall, sprint forwards. Bolt rounds smack against them, spinning two back off their feet, but the remainder do not falter. They fire when the doors are almost closed, when the word-bearers beyond can only be seen by their glowing eyes and muzzle flashes. The melter guns scream lines of thin, burning atmosphere at the closing doors. Plasteel and brass ripple like fat under flame. The graviton gun fires a second later, and the doors cascade from their frames in a ragged spill of white-hot metal. Sigismund is running again, Rahn at his side, heat warnings chiming as glowing sparks splash around them. And then they are through into the passage beyond, molten slag scattering in their wake. A killing rhythm flows through Sigismund. It feels different, detached, like a tableau moving before him, painted in blurred speed and a spray of blood. He stops. The passage is a wide darkness before him. Now silent and empty. A false wind is gusting around him as air sucks out through the breach in the outer chamber wall. Rahn breaks away, pressing forward, his shield bearers bracketing him in a tight wall. For a second in the silence, Sigismund thinks he catches a distant voice that is just below hearing. He looks down at his sword. Blood has clotted in the links of the chain binding it to his wrist.
This is only the beginning.
He looks up. Morn walks towards him, the pistols in her hands trailing heat haze and vapor from their barrels. Her two bodyguards walk a pace behind her, their rotor cannons cycling down.
You are wondering why, after all your anger at the betrayers, that this now feels like nothing.
Sigismund looks back through the doors. Blood-shrouded shapes cover the floor. There are bodies armored in yellow amongst the crimson gloss. His eyes focus on a severed arm, still clutching a gladius in its gauntleted fingers.
You are thinking that you are a blood killer now, a slayer of your gene kin.
He looks up at her. There is no longer any laughter in her eyes. She nods once.
You are, First Captain. That is exactly what you are.
He turns without replying and moves to follow Rahn. His sword feels heavy in his hand, and the chain binding it clinks against his wrist. It has been less than 2 minutes since he killed the first word-bearer. Khan grinned as the sword sliced towards his ribs. He was still grinning as he lashed the phalanx blade towards Sigismund's throat. The blow was fast, fast enough that a human would barely have seen it, but Sigismund was already stepping back and slicing downwards. The World Eater caught the descending strike between his paired blades, scissoring past the sword, and slashed out again. Sigismund met the cut with the flat of his sword, point down, guard high. Khan's blade slid past. Sigismund flicked his sword over and cut back. Khan froze. Sigismund watched the vein in the side of the World Eater's neck beat once against the sword edge. A thick worm of blood crawled across the polished plastile, clotting even as it ran down his bared chest. Khan snarled. The muscles of his neck bunched against the sword. The flesh around his eyes was twitching, and he was breathing hard, though not from fatigue. Sigismund raised an eyebrow. Khan spat, reversed his grip on his twin blades, and turned away. Beneath the waist, he wore simple black trews tied with a length of rope. Sigismund whipped the sword blade through the air, blood drops shaking from it to scatter on the sand-covered floor. In contrast, he wore a simple robe of white crossed with black, cut so that the flesh of his arms was bare to the dull light. Armor was customary for the fighting pits of the World Eaters, but not in this case, not between these two. The curved walls of the pit were raw iron, marked by gouges from weapons and dappled with dried blood. Sigismund sniffed as he lifted his gaze to the rank tiers above the lip of the pit. Silence and emptiness stared back at him. He looked to where Khan hung his paired blades from a weapon rack. The World Eater's breath was still ragged, his scalp still twitching around the metal of his aggression implants. His butcher's nails.
Again?
Khan's hands moved over the weapons on the rack, touching the haft of a long chain axe, lingering on the coils of a meteor hammer. But he picked out a sword, the blade as wide as his arm,